The AI Fundamentalists, a podcast about the fundamentals of safe and resilient modeling systems behind the AI that impacts our lives and our businesses. Here are your hosts, Andrew Clark and Sid Mungalik.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to another episode of The AI Fundamentalists. This week on this episode, we are going to switch it up a little bit. We usually like to start off with the news, but there's been something on our mind because of the news, and we think we'd be doing you a huge disservice if we didn't really define the topic how we want to first, and that is the topic of digital twins.
Yeah, let's hop in a little bit. Let's think about what are digital twins. You know, maybe you start to see this term floating around in your inbox or in your newsletters. And let's really examine what is the digital twin and what is not the digital twin, which, as we'll get in later, is where we're seeing a little bit of confusion in the market. From its inception, the idea of a digital twin is that it should be a one-to-one digital model of a real-life intended product or system or process. And you might call that real one the physical twin, right? So our digital twin and our physical twin. The idea is then that the digital twin should be pretty much indistinguishable from your physical twin, which means you can then use your digital twin to run simulations, integrations, testing, monitoring, maintenance, or practice decommission, right? So really going back to our system engineering and thinking about how can we do these types of big problems on a safe in-computer digital twin. And ideally, these kind of things will coexist, right? That you'll always have your digital twin and your physical twin at the same time. So as your physical twin suffers damage or is used in the real world, the digital twin can perfectly map that out, and you can do new play testing, new troubleshooting on a modeled version of the real problem. And I'll hop over to Andrew to describe why this type of paradigm is useful and where it's been used before.
Really? It sounds like a little bit of a broken record on this podcast, but this comes back to, guess where? Apollo program with NASA was one of the first documented use cases of where a digital twin was used to really replicate some areas of like the spaceship systems and be able to stress test and understand those relationships and start that wiring. Digital twins today are very useful in manufacturing. You can have digital twin setups in aerospace engineering. I used to work for a company. I did economic digital twins, essentially building how economic systems would work, specifically on blockchain and distributed technologies. So digital twins has a lot of use cases for today, but I think it's often misunderstood on doing simulations or validating models and things like that. A lot of times people are calling those digital twins. And as Sid laid out, digital twin is a very specific thing. It's a digital replica of a physical process, which is very helpful in manufacturing and space and in areas like that. So we want to just kind of level set today on the podcast on what they can be useful for, what they're not, and go from there.
Yeah, and let's just lay it out very firmly and very formally. So while this term first showed up in 2010 in a NASA research guide, it actually dates back a little bit earlier, early 2000s, with Greaves and Vickers stating, a digital twin is a set of virtual information constructs that fully describes a potential or actual physical manufactured product from the micro scale to the macro geometrical scale. At its optimum, any information that could be obtained from inspecting a physical manufactured product can be obtained from its digital twin. So let's try and ground ourselves to that a little bit. Now let's talk about when that doesn't come across in the media that we see and how they talk about it. So there's this, and I don't want to single them out as being like the people that do this, but you know, VentureBeat put out an article where they describe 10 digital twin trends. And they try and walk through and describe some things that they've noticed using the keywords digital trend and share them with their readers. And I think now's a good time for Andrew and I to kind of break down, you know, some of the issues with these digital twins that they claim are digital twins. And then also just describe some general rules you can follow for identifying what is and isn't a digital twin.
Great framing, Sid. Digital twin is there's some good papers we can link in the show notes. It's a very interesting field and something I'm personally very passionate about. But it is definitely, it's kind of like some of the AI use cases. It's not a one size fits all. People are starting to be, it's like, get on the hype train. We all want to say we're doing these things. It's a tool in your toolbox and it's a great tool, but it's not the only tool and it doesn't mean it applies everywhere. So as looking through some of these VentureBeat examples, one of them was from connecting files to connecting data. So legacy file formats, things change. How can you try and make integration patterns better for data and like interoperability and things? Okay, so we need to find data standards and we need to use ETL, extract, transfer, load processes to handle different vendors and different forms of data, you know, transporting mainframe data and all those things. That's nothing to do with the digital twin. It's digital. So I guess there's digital trends. Maybe this should be a digital trends article, not a digital twins article. I think maybe there's some semantical difference as where people get confused there.
I read this article and what was striking me is, like you said earlier, these are perfect. Digital twins are near perfect replicas of the system that of their twin, you know, case in point. But what was striking me from the article is that a lot of the things that they were describing were simulations, like you said before, or just sandbox environments where you probably would do like 40 to 50% of the test before you would render something like, okay, it's ready for, you know, ready for production or ready to try in production. And that's what was, you know, with what you just said and how you guys just defined it to its purest of what a digital twin is. Yeah, I agree. This is something that people have to take into consideration now that digital twin is very loosely being used for use cases to test generative AI, in particular, some ChatGPT work.
And I think that's a great point in the, where people are getting confused. So at Monitor, we're very much pro-validation. And we have our own suite of validation tests. A lot of my PhD work was that. Sid has a lot of experience in validation. So we're very much pro-validations. So validations, as you have a model and you want to determine like where those safe operating bounds, is it performant? Is it fair? Is it meeting the business objectives? Where can I run this model? Where does it break down? All of those types of things. Adversarial testing for any security-related incidents, all that kind of stuff. So validations is a hugely important topic, and you can't in anything, okay, generative as well, but even a tabular model or traditional deep neural or XGBoost or anything, you can't really reasonably deploy a mission critical model without validating the model and understanding that it's doing what you want it to do. So validation is an extremely important topic, and you definitely can't be using any sort of generative, which is not optimized for accuracy. It's optimized to sound human. Or it's not optimized for accuracy or retrieval. We have a podcast previously where we talked about how you could use semantic search and knowledge graphs for those use cases. But validation is the bare bones requirement you have to do if you want to be moving forward with these systems. So when people are saying we need to be doing digital twins to validate, yes, you're correct. You need to be validating your models, but you're just, I don't quite know how digital twin has become this word that people are appropriating for different use cases.
Yeah, and I think this gets to what I think is the most common mistake about what is and isn't a digital twin. It's thinking that an AI model, which models data, is a digital twin of that data. But that's fundamentally a misconception and a confusion, because the idea is that you should have a physical system which is understood fully physically, and then you reinterpret and then you rewrite that system into a computer. There should be no layer of, I think this is how this works, or I'm going to guess how this works, or I'm going to optimize some loss curve to get something that approximates the original behavior. What you want is something that actually models that behavior directly via systems code.
Sid, that was an amazing definition. That's it. I think that's the root of where a lot of this confusion is. And as part of what we had Christoph Molnar on the podcast a few podcasts ago talking about model paradigms, one of the key aspects of modeling, this is also a misconception that people are thinking, you know, AI and things are like Terminator style or this, they're thinking and they can handle these things. No, modeling, no matter what paradigm, even LLMs or any of that jazz, you are taking an abstraction of reality, you're simplifying it, and you're trying to replicate, as Sid said, the data. What's the data specifically, and how can we make a model that best fits that for that specific use case? And that's where there's that confusion that you can just build something that's generalizable across other areas. And there's, of course, work and foundation models and things where you can try and generalize. But in general, generalizing is not an approach you can reliably count on. And you need to validate that the model is as closely adhering to that underlying system or that underlying data that you want and is accurate on that specific data set. So I think there's that kind of misconception around what modeling is and what it does, and the confusion that we're not at Terminator stage where you have cognizant models that are making decisions. They have to be very particular on the context.
That in that same article, there was one underlying point across several of the cases where it was loosely, digital twins were loosely called out, was that like a physical system and a cloud system, even those, they're not twins of each other just by nature of what they are. And I think that also adds even more confusion, because we do see a lot of businesses by nature are this hybrid environment, if not all one or the other themselves. So that just adds to the complexity. Is there anything else that we saw about these cases that, you know, might lend itself to the same confusion?
Yeah, another really common example is this idea that if you're going to do a traffic system and you're going to model a traffic system, well, all I need is some 3D renderings of the model of the, like, let's say the Manhattan suburb area. And let's just pass it around and say, hey, this is a digital twin of the original data. But what these types of just simulations via renderings is missing is the idea that data interacts with itself and data interacts with the real world. You can't play around with this type of system, and you can't observe how the system is behaving relative to the real world system. This is like the level of elevation that goes between just reconstructing and rebuilding the original system in a digital space.
But in that same sense, we're hearing digital twins again, you know, and I think you had mentioned a paper that had been out about the digital twin paradigm and the future of NASA and how it brings out some of these points.
Yes, that paper was back in 2012. And as Sid mentioned earlier in the history, digital twins originally kind of were being used in Apollo. You had a loose connection. It was a little tenuous then. And then that Vickers definition that he gave from that paper, Michael Greaves and John Vickers in 2002 is really when this started becoming a thing again. But it didn't really take off until 2012 when NASA did their new paper, Digital Twin Paradigm for Future NASA and U.S. Air Force Vehicles. So it was a partnership with Air Force. That was really when we were starting to get the explosion of IoT really having that speed up in data. And I think it just kind of made a lot of people's imaginations go. And there's a topic about digital cities and all this kind of stuff. I think a lot of people got excited about that. And as you're starting to do more companies working in IoT and things. Also, I think we're just really getting more into this buzzword culture where everybody wants to be part of like some forward technology. So all of these are contributing factors. And we have started, because of that revolution of the chips and things, we have started getting to a spot where it can be used by manufacturing companies and other companies that aren't NASA. Like there isn't a place where you can start using it. So I just think there's a little bit of confusion on, yes, it is usable for more companies. And it is a paradigm that's worth exploring, but also then taking that and generalizing it for a bunch of different use cases.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. There's just a lot of hype training around digital twins, and it's a perfect storm of other hype trains too. Right? You think about ambient sensors, medical implants, wearables, IoT devices. And these are all very big parts of making real digital twin systems, right? If you're going to make a digital twin of a bridge, you're going to have sensors on there. You're going to have monitoring of it. You're going to have IoT devices across this physical system to monitor and really make that perfect digital twin. And then the confusion comes that just because we have these devices, we are now doing digital twinning. You know, wearing your Apple Watch is not making a digital twin of you.
And that's the precise point. Just because you're using IoT, IoT does not equal digital twin. Digital does not equal digital twin. And I think there's been confusion around that. But there's also, strangely enough, there's not really like a, you have to be technical to be able to build digital twins. There's
MathLink or Simulink or what's that one I'm thinking of? MathLab. Is it MathLab? There's one tool that has the ability to do some digital twins, but it's pretty complex. Like you really, the accessibility of digital twins is also, that's what's kind of strange with the hype train around it. It's not near as accessible as machine learning. Anybody can go to Kaggle and follow some tutorials and do something in machine learning. Digital twins are not easy for anybody to jump on. So that's a little bit of paradox on, I'm surprised we're hearing about them so much.
I think we still haven't gotten to the place where we understand why they're coming up so often now with generative AI and the latest hype cycle on how people are going to use them to further the technology. There are also some implications because there are some implications for security and privacy and safety that are their own animal. Let's dig into that.
That's a great point to bring up because one area where I've heard a lot of discussions about it, and there is actually a use case, is in healthcare for, you know, simulating hospitals or trying to find fast, like if you simulate OR rooms and things and try and figure out, can we more efficiently move around and all those sorts of things. Well, now you start dealing into HIPAA and personal data and different things like that. And I was reading an article recently that like majority of cyber attacks right now are happening at hospitals and healthcare because there's lots of data there, but also traditionally healthcare has not been like finance or any of these other industries that are really invested in cybersecurity. That's been a major issue. Healthcare also has a lot of those IoT devices and things. Just even think pacemakers, or there's been even instances of, you know, any type of machine that people are plugged into, someone could hack into that. So there's a lot of issues there. So specifically now, if you're like, hey, we're building, I'm Kaiser Healthcare, and I don't know if they're doing it, I'm just using it as an example. We're building a digital twin. Okay. All hackers. Now let's go. They're just telling us, here's some great data we might want to get to. So it really raises the stakes for a lot of these companies on if you're wanting to do digital twins, you have to really make sure, assuming you do have a use case for them, that you have your data really locked down.
Yeah. And it's really a tale of two data privacies, right? On one end, digital twins was supposed to be what was going to solve this problem. It was supposed to be, instead of having a patient in the lab and monitoring their heart physically all the time, getting their real heart data and having to store that on hardware, let's just make a digital twin of it. Let's work on it there. Let's operate on it there. Let's learn about what we need to do in the simulated computer environment and then only do the minimal amount that we need to with the real person. Or that you would only need to monitor the digital system and not have to monitor the physical system as deeply. But on the other side, anytime you work with an IoT device, you're making a cybersecurity expert very upset and angry. No cybersecurity professor has a Google Home on their device because there's this intrinsic problem with edge device and edge computing where the cybersecurity risks, you know, we tweak them down a little bit. We say, well, I'm willing to give up some data ownership. I'm willing to give up some personal security. I'm willing to give up some vectors for contamination to have these types of large integrated systems. So we're really in this almost back and forth where this was supposed to solve a problem that this ends up creating.
You made me laugh just a little bit in that one description because I'm waiting for the comments now from the cybersecurity people saying like, well, I have one. Well, no, I don't, you know, to, you know, really drive your point home. But it's true. I mean, there are people who know how these systems work and will tell you straight up, you are not protected. You do have to stay vigilant about your own data and your own privacy because, you know, these are fallible. These are humans that are building this and kind of figuring it out. And just by nature of handing over your entire life and your entire profile to something without reservation, you know, that's complicated.
This is probably a full podcast on itself is data privacy and data security. But as we've mentioned before, we're all fans of Gary Marcus on this podcast. He had a recent post talking about like the dirty underbelly or something about AI, which even got into how Tesla wants to collect all this information about your personal life and even I think sexual orientation and all this creepy stuff in Tesla. And it says if you opt out of it, parts of your vehicle may not work. Or we can't guarantee that it'll work or stuff. So like they're actually really, this data privacy thing goes very deep. And this like IoT and digital twin discussion is just really the beginning of it. It's a larger problem with like feed the beast and AI right now. They want all this data for all these different things. As we've seen with OpenAI and, you know, copyright issues and all this stuff, there's been this large data collection engine below the scenes that is now starting to become visible, which privacy becomes a huge component. And, you know, maybe it doesn't matter for some of these cursory activities, but if we're starting to really digital twins and things about your health data while you're being operated on and stuff, yeah, it gets really, the stakes are a lot higher now for the security.
Now, and such a fine line between consumer use, like using a car and wanting that data from people who are driving cars or like getting these services in cars, like heated seats through a subscription. And that's a very trite example, but it's still the granularity at which, you know, companies are asking for your data in these systems. But then there's also the problem is that there's some very real use cases, like we were citing in medicine, in surgery, in therapeutics, where that information is so critical. But I think we're summing this up here over the course of the podcast that's why digital twins, if someone's proposing that as the solution to have that really critical system mapped and, you know, being able to work back and forth between each other, this is why we have to really regard these systems as they're not simulators. They're not sandboxes. They can't be treated that way. They can't be approached that way. You really have to go into this as if it is going to be the live system. First and foremost, make it and then almost clone it so that you know which, almost like a left and right hand, and they know what they're doing.
Great points. And that's why it's actually a really good thing. I don't think it's intentional, but why I think the market's also smaller than talking, but there's not comprehensive solutions for building digital twins in a box. That's actually a very good thing for everybody's personal privacy, that there's not that solution. And they're also very complicated to build and very use case specific. So there are lots of technical reasons. And I actually don't think the market is quite as big as the discussion is around them. But that's one of the things we've talked about here before. And with AI is almost too accessible, where people are now doing things with it you probably shouldn't be doing because we've been able to democratize it so much and lower the bar. And I'm all for, you know, more people in tech and learning tech and all that stuff. But the problem is you're deploying systems, production, things you maybe shouldn't be doing. So the fact that digital twin has a little bit of a higher barrier to entry, I think is a good thing currently, at least for data security and privacy.
Yeah, I guess, like, you know, in closing thought, I'll say that this reminds me a lot of the discussions we have around AI systems. Build them because you need them and not because you want them. A digital twin system is a very meaningfully long-term, large business decision to make. You will have to rebuild your system twice. Why build it twice if the cost of the system breaking is not the cost of the system breaking twice? It's a very intentional decision. It should be made with the right hopes and goals in mind. And it's not just something you can do frivolously.
Well put, Sid. We'll leave our listeners with that thought, a very strong underscore for today's topic about digital twins. And for our listeners, or our AI fundamentalists out there, if you will, we have an email address and we love hearing from you. Keep the questions coming. It's theaifundamentalists@monitor.ai. Please drop us a note. Your questions help us build our future podcasts. Until next time.